Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. When we pay our respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, the words of the chanting and the sort of customary forms address the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha's external qualities. Buddha as referring to the historical teacher, and the Dhamma as the teachings, and the Sangha as those who have awakened to that reality of the Dhamma. But there is an internal aspect to the three refuges that is what makes them a real refuge. A refuge is a safe place. Like we have this wonderful, cool, rainy weather. Reminds me of England. I left this behind in England, and here it is too. So it's wonderful to have this refuge, this shelter. It's a nice, safe, warm, cozy place to be in the cool, dark, soggy, grey weather. So a refuge is a safe place. So then the idea of the Buddha as a teacher, or the memory, is not a safe refuge. It's not anything that provides real security. So what the Buddha as a refuge is, then, as a genuine, say, shelter or abiding place, is the internal quality of awareness itself. Well, the word Buddha means awake, that which is aware, awake, knowing. So to take refuge in Buddha is to choose to be awake, to choose to be wise. And this is a theme that Ajahn Chah used to expound upon a great deal. He'd often quite shock his visitors by saying, the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago, he's not a refuge. He's gone. He's not around. So, you know, even if you guys pray to him, he's not listening. He's gone. People always like a few deities around to help things along. But Lumpo Cha would point out that what makes Buddha a refuge is that the Buddha is the one who knows, the awakefulness, awareness of your own heart. Similarly, Dhamma, when we pay respects to Dhamma, then that's not just the verbal teachings of the Buddha, it's not just the words or the ideas, the explanations, but Dhamma means the way things are, the fundamental reality of nature. Physical, mental, spiritual. So that to take refuge in Dhamma is to attune the heart to the reality of things, to say, let go of self-centered thinking, to let go of how we think things should be or could be or ought to be or used to be, but instead to open the heart to how it is in this very present moment. A refuge in Sangha, you can render in different ways. Sangha literally means the unified assembly, or those separate parts joined harmoniously together. So when we think or consider Sangha as a refuge internally, so externally, the verses talking about the Sangha, we talk about the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, those who have entered upon and fulfilled the levels, four different levels of enlightenment. But Sangha as an internal refuge, that in which enables us to harmonize with others, that which helps us to unify with other beings, is the quality of goodness, of nobility. So to take refuge in Sangha is to choose that in your heart that loves the good. It's my current favorite way of rendering it. So that in our heart which rejoices in the wholesome, in the noble, in the beautiful, to take refuge in Sangha means that to choose the good. And these are our reliable refuges. These are our, say, when the heart abides in those qualities, then there's a genuine and a fundamental quality of security and stability in the face of all change. One of the things I thought to reflect upon this evening, start off with speaking about perception and feeling, and particularly the feeling of pain, physical pain. Here we are, we spent a day together. Might feel like a lot longer than that. Even though many of us are old warriors, been in the Dharma trenches for many decades, at least several decades. Even so, even though we might have done many, many retreats, it still surprises me how long a single day can be. You know, we only met together 24 hours ago. Well, 25, to be strictly accurate. We had our first gathering together, you know, 7:30 yesterday evening. It's 8:30 now, the next day. 25 hours. Yeah, how many universes have come into being and fallen apart in that time? A lot happens in a single day. And, lot happening can, also be, because life becomes a lot more simple. We follow a standard routine, and we're spending a lot more time just paying attention to the body, to the mind, and sitting still. Being with the body and its feelings, not distracting ourselves with conversation, with looking at the news, exchanging emails, filling out our blog, keeping the universe informed of all of our activities. We put all that aside. So what do we have? We have the body. We have our thoughts and feelings, perceptions. So we notice a lot of physical discomfort. Not only, I'm sure there's some pleasurable things as well, but it's the issue of physical pain and how we work with it is usually very pertinent as we enter into a time of retreat, particularly if the weather is cold and grey and rainy. Then we're going to be inclined to spend a bit more time indoors, and a bit more in the sitting posture. So therefore, it's helpful to consider how we relate to that perception, the perception of discomfort or the feeling of discomfort. So in this respect, that the Buddha gave a wonderful and very simple teaching. It's called a short sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya called the Arrow. And as many of you might know, the Buddha was a soldier before he became a monk. So he uses a lot of military analogies. So he was a warrior noble. He was a crown prince of his small Himalayan nation. And so he was trained for military action. I mean, I'm sure all of you have been in the same position in the Israeli army one way or another. I might be the only person in the room who hasn't been in the Israeli army. But anyway, even if we haven't, it's interesting, helpful to reflect that the Buddha does use a lot of military similes and analogies in the way he explains teaching. So the simile, the teaching of the arrow relates to the image of a soldier being shot with an arrow. And he said, physical pain is like being shot with an arrow. He says, there's nobody, there's no being that is born that escapes that first arrow. If you have a body, if you have a mind, you're necessarily going to experience painful feeling, along with pleasant feeling and neutral feeling. The system is built to experience pain, so that's going to happen. So that what he called the first arrow, is unavoidable. So when we talk about ending suffering, it doesn't mean never experiencing pain. But then he said that the second arrow is being shot with a second arrow in the same place. He said that second arrow, that is optional. That is something that can be avoided. And the second arrow is all of the mind's worrying, negotiating, resenting, fearing, that it creates around the feelings of pain. So if we have an ache in our back or in our knee, there's a strange new sharp sensation suddenly pops up. What's that? What's happening there? The mind moves easily towards worry, towards fear. When pain has arisen, we tense up against it. We dislike it. We cultivate a reasonable hatred towards. That's another of my favorite phrases. A reasonable hatred towards that pain in my knee or my back or wherever it might be, and so it becomes an ongoing grumble. If you're familiar with that English word. Just moaning and complaining. Oh, I don't like this. This isn't fair. Why isn't it going away? If only this wasn't here, I would be happy. Grumble, grumble, grumble. It's very normal states of a mind to experience. So the second arrow, as the Buddha pointed out, it is the one that the teachings about ending dukkha are about. Because so the if we experience the first arrow, then there still can be painful feeling, but the peace of mind, the peace of the mind, the quality of equanimity and clarity does not have to be obstructed by that experience. There can still be that feeling, but there can be a clear and unobstructed knowledge that this is simply a feeling. When the second arrow is there, and when the mind starts to negotiate with the painful feeling or resents it, tenses up against it, then that peace is gone. There is the mind is caught up in creating stress around that that painful feeling. So this is a very helpful model, I find, to have to describe the situation that we experience, because when we realize that the majority of the suffering, the dukkha, is really the second arrow. And that when we see that, and then we notice the way that the mind is relating to a painful feeling. It's our shoulders, our neck, our back, our legs, whatever it might be. So then, noticing that and being able to name that as the second arrow, as the kind of additional and you can call adventitious, if you want a nice long English word, adventitious suffering coming from outside. It has sort of come in. Then we realize we can do something about that. The Buddha said the first arrow is unavoidable. The second arrow is definitely avoidable. So if we notice that, then we can see how the body is tensed up against that painful feeling. And we can relax the body. When we relax the body, we can also relax the attitude. So there, through our wise reflection and patience, we can learn to relax the attitude to, as I've been saying, cultivate instead an attitude of acceptance, a radical acceptance, even to the unpleasant. We don't have to generate hatred towards pain. We can be patient with it, not waiting for it to be over. The English word patience, I'm not sure what the Hebrew would be, but the English word patience implies something of a implies a resentment, like you're just toughing it out. So you really don't want it to be there, but you're making yourself wait, and you've got the strength to not react, but you still are generating negativity. But being patient is a state of, in a way, of ongoing resentment, but you're able to stay with a painful feeling through a sheer act of will. Just, I'm going to stay with it. So the Buddhist form of patience, which is described with the Pali word khanti, khanti, is not a resentment. It's what it's more to do with is a letting go of time. So true patience, which is a paramita, which is a form of liberation, is when you are learning how to not wait. You're not waiting for it to be over, because as soon as the mind absorbs into time, then there's dukkha. It's caught into that habit of becoming, and that very quality is stressful. So the letting go of the second arrow, or avoiding the second arrow, is a lot to do with that sense of patience, of the attitude of not waiting for it to be over, of surrender, of letting go of time, of not waiting. This is not an easy quality to develop, but if we know that that's possible, and we steer our efforts towards that, then we find, to our surprise and our delight, that when you relax the body, then you realize that the stressing up, the tensing against the pain, was actually increasing it. So to put some numbers on it, so maybe you're experiencing a level 7 pain in your knee. By relaxing the body and the muscles, the tendons around that, then a level 7 pain drops to a level 4. And then by relaxing the attitude towards it, then even though it's a level 4 pain, it's absolutely not a problem. Now, this doesn't mean that it's not legal to change your posture. Don't worry, it's perfectly kosher. There's nothing illegal or inappropriate about changing your posture. But what this kind of clarity, or the letting go of the stressing and negotiating, avoiding the second arrow, what that does is that it allows our own intuitive wisdom to operate. So that, as I was saying a bit earlier today, how when we are truly awake, then rather than me doing something to get some result somewhere, we allow mindfulness and wisdom to be what dictates or what guides action. In exactly the same way, our body has its own intelligence. So if you think that relaxing the body and being patient with a feeling of pain means that you're just going to be with it forever until your knee breaks, or you really do need a trip to the osteopath or the knee surgeon, that's not the case. But more, what this is talking about is letting that attitude of radical acceptance sort of clear the space, and that lets the heart respond to that painful feeling. So then, at a certain point, when that pain has been there for some time, then you have a clear intuitive sense. Okay, that's enough. Time to move. And so then the changing of the posture is then done from an act of kindness for the body rather than an act of aversion towards the pain. So the cause of the change is based on well wishing towards your own body, and rather than I hate this, I fear this, I resent this, this shouldn't be there, how can I get away from this, oh no, it's come back again, oh no, what am I going to do? You know, and that feeling when you change your posture, you think, ah, bliss, and then, oh no, not the other one. Yeah. And so that this is a way of training ourselves to see the value of being, of letting mindfulness and wisdom be the guide for our actions. So this is probably familiar territory, and I'm almost certain that Stephen and the other teachers amongst you have been explaining this over and over for many years. But it's one of those things, even though you've heard it a thousand times, even if you've explained it, you know, hundreds or a thousand times, it's still useful to recollect. You know, sometimes I'm giving the explanation about this, and I go, "Oh yeah, right." I'm always explaining this. I kind of forget to do it too. Oh yeah, right. Yeah, must remember to apply that myself. Yeah. So then, another teaching that the Buddha gave that deepens this sense of relating to feeling and to perception in a more completely wise and attuned way, and this is probably a teaching again that many of you have heard or reflected upon, but it's a very significant and useful expression of this area of wisdom, particularly talking of the aspect of non-duality or the deeper qualities of wisdom, understanding. This is a teaching given by the Buddha to a wanderer called Bahia. And as the story goes, Bahia was a teacher, was a leader of a different spiritual group, far away from where the Buddha was living. And as the story goes in the scriptures, one night this devata appeared to Bahia, and Bahia was under the impression that he was a totally enlightened being, and this devata, who had apparently been a relative of Bahia's previously when the devata was a human, came to Bahia in the night and said, "Well, you think you're an arahant, but actually you're not, and you're not even on the pathway to becoming an arahant, to becoming enlightened." And then Bahia, to his credit, after he'd sort of taken umbrage for a little bit, you know, "What do you mean? Who do you think you are?" But because it was a devata talking to him, I guess that kind of carried a bit of weight, or at least a bit of light. So Bahia said, "Well, so, you know, are there any enlightened beings in the world? You know, and if so, where are they?" Grumble, grumble. And then the devata said, "Yes, indeed, there are enlightened beings in the world, and the greatest of the enlightened ones is the Buddha Gautama, and he lives in Sarvati, in the area of Sarvati, the capital of Kosala." So, again, to his credit, Bahia just started walking then and there, and set off, and walked for many days to get to Sarvati to meet the Buddha. So he had a certain single-mindedness in the way that he operated. And he arrived in Sarvati early in the morning and then encountered the Buddha while he was walking through the streets of the town on his morning alms round with his alms bowl and with the other monks behind him. So walking in a line as we do in our custom. So then Bahia saw the Buddha and then immediately knelt down before him and said, "Venerable sir, please teach me the Dhamma. You know, you are the Buddha Gautama and I wish to learn from you." And the Buddha said, "Well, Bahia, this is not the time for giving Dhamma teachings. We're in the middle of the street and this is, you know, halfway through our alms round, so this is not really a convenient moment." And Bahia said, "Venerable sir, life is uncertain. Neither you or I know when we might die, so please teach me the Dhamma." And as often happens usually happens, they go back and forth three times. You know, we always seem to be doing things three times over. And so then after the third time of making that request, the Buddha said, "Well, when a Tathagata is pressed up to the third time for the question, he has to answer. So Bahia, I will give you a teaching. Pay attention." So he then gives Bahia this very succinct, Dhamma, transmission. He says, "In the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the sensed, like smelt, tasted, touched, There is only the sensed, and in the cognized, there is only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself, Bahia. You should train yourself to see things in this way. When you see, when you know that in the seen there is only the seen and so forth, then you will realize that there is no thing here. You will realize that the subject, the knower is empty. You will see there is no thing here. And when you realize, when you awaken to that truth that there is no thing here, you will also realize that indeed there is also no thing there, that the world of the object, so there's no individual separate person who's the experiencer, and that the objects of sense are also not separate independent entities either. And thus, Bahia, when you realize, when you know there is no thing here and there is no thing there, you will not be able to locate yourself either in the world of this or in the world of that or anywhere between the two. This, Bahia, is the end of suffering. So, Bahia, having made that long journey, been walking for a month or two to get there, to his credit, again, he became an arahant then and there. I think he has the record, and the Buddha did give prizes occasionally, that people had awards for particular achievements and skills and qualities, and Bahia was given the recognition of being the one who understood the teaching quickest. And so just in that short delivery, it takes what, a couple of minutes to recount, then right there he immediately became an arahant. And also he was right about life being uncertain, because those who are chuckling probably know the next part of the story is then he said, well, can I become a monk in your community? And the Buddha said, well, do you have a robe? Do you have a bowl? And he was an ascetic who wore clothes made out of tree bark. He was a bark-wearing ascetic. And so he didn't have a cloth robe and didn't have a bowl. He just accepted food into his hands. And so he said, I don't have a bowl and I only have this clothing made out of tree bark. So the Buddha said, well, if you find a robe and a bowl, then I'll give you the going forth as a monk. So then Bahia went off to find a robe and bowl. And then while he was going through the town, then this runaway cow in the lanes of Savatthi collided with him, gored him in the side, and knocked him down, and he died right there in the street. So he was correct. Yeah, life is uncertain, and it was good that he got the teaching when he did. So this is a very potent theme for reflection, and it speaks about the area that this retreat is themed upon, about the non-dual teachings, insofar as it's pointing towards the development of subjectless, objectless awareness or knowing, and the Buddha phrases it very beautifully as you're starting off with this contemplation of feeling, of perception, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, the world of thought and cognition. That if that's, and this is what we're doing with Vipassana, insight meditation, we're looking at the process of experiencing, how experience works. So in a way, it's like we're looking at the phenomenology of experience, how stuff is known. And how the mind weaves together this present experience from hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, from language, memory, imagination. It puts it all together and says, Tovana, Tuesday evening, rain, indoor. That's what that Dhamma talk says, you know, that's what this comes together and is formed in our perceptions as. So what the Buddha is teaching Bahia is about how to deconstruct that present moment experience. In the heard, in the seen, there is only the seen. There is seeing. In the heard, there is only the heard. There is hearing. In the sensed, what is felt, what is tasted, what is smelt by the nose. What is thought in the mind, our memories, our emotions, our ideas, our projections, all of that, the process of cognizing itself, though, the whole intellectual domain. Just to know it, a thought is just a thought, thinking is just thinking, remembering is just remembering. That all of these patterns, whether it's a smell, a sensation, an idea, these are just patterns of consciousness woven into being, and the mind creates its impression of the world, its version of the world. And as I like to say, what we experience is not the world. We experience our mind's version of the world. And there's times when the Buddha spells this out. He says, what is the world? The eye is the world. The ear is the world. The nose is the world. The tongue is the world. The body is the world. The mind is the world. That is what we call the world in this dispensation. That is loka, the world. So in a way, the Buddha was the first phenomenologist. Phenomenologist. You know, that he sort of predated all those good people like Husserl and such. Rather than creating theories about the universe and making much of that, he was bringing our attention to the felt experience of our minds in each moment. And then what he encourages Bahia to do then, by noticing how when we appreciate the nature of experience, then you can't find an experiencer. And these the teachings on anatta, on not self, point to that, and that there can be the mind can say, yeah, but I am thinking, I am remembering, that in ordinary conventional terms we talk about the way, you know, I am talking. Yeah, you know, well, it's conventionally speaking, yes, Ajahn Amaro is talking, and all you guys are listening, hopefully. But what the Buddha's pointing to is that every single conception of I as the thinker, I as the talker, I as the experiencer, I'm the one who's trying to understand, I'm the one who's remembering, I'm the one who's comparing this with another idea, all those I ams are convenient fictions. They're conceivings, that the mind conceives that feeling of I into being. It's not intrinsically there. And the more that you look, the more that you can't find the process of investigation, of inquiry, the whole development of insight is about the peeling away, the falling away of those habits of identification. We start off by thinking, well, I am a man, or I am a woman, I am Israeli, I am English, I'm Belgian, I'm German. That's what I am. And then by looking and feeling it through, then, and exploring those kind of qualities of, well, if that thought is mine, what's the thing here that does the owning? And how is any thing owned? And when those are looked at and explored not in the blur of a whole mass of activity, but clearly and directly, then there's that oh. Or those of you who are familiar with the tales of Winnie the Pooh, to speak of other scriptures for a moment, you have an anglicized education as well as the Dharmic. In the tales of Winnie the Pooh, there's an experience of where Winnie the Pooh and his friend Piglet get separated from each other, and there's been a snowstorm, Pooh is walking around and around this little wood. And he sees more and more tracks in the snow, and he's looking, and each time he goes around, there's more footprints in the snow, and he thinks that there's they're chasing after the heffalumps, or what must be a herd of elephants. And he's also got separated from Piglet, so he's worrying about where Piglet is, and so he gets really concerned. And then he comes up with this marvelous phrase, which is the reason why I'm quoting it, which is, "The more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there." So if you want a different way of exploring these principles, that's a handy thing. The more that you look for yourself, then the more you find that you're not there. And so what we're doing with these reflections on anatta is not trying to come up with the perfect theory of what I really, really, really am, but to get the sense of the Buddha's intent in putting forth that teaching, is that any kind of conception of what we are is necessarily wide of the mark. And I was having a conversation earlier today with Stephen about this, you know, particular phrase that appears repeatedly in the scriptures about that quality of conceiving, of forming the I, forming an image of the self, even a sort of cosmic self or a universal self, or a self that's one with all beings, of a super self. Speaking of physical pain. So the Pali phrase is yena yena hi manyanti tatatang hoti anyatati. And it translates as, whatever they conceive it to be, the truth is always other than that. Whatever they conceive it to be, yena yena hi manyanti tatatang hoti anyatati. It's always other. So it's not as though we haven't done enough thinking yet. You know, if you were a super, super sharp philosopher, you could find the way to phrase it that will get it right. What the Buddha's pointing to is that, well, the more you look, you know, the more you look, the more it's not going to be there. Because that quality is not formable into a concept. So the whole process of reflection on anicca, dukkha, anatta is helping us to stop identifying with what we're not, so that then what is can be directly realized. Not formed into a concept or an idea or into a word, but known through direct awakening. So that in that teaching to Bahia, we have subjectless, objectless awareness. Where the Buddha says, you'll see there is no thing here. If you see there's no thing here, the self feelings are empty, then you will also see that there's no thing there, that all the objects of sense, what's seen, heard, smelt, tasted, touched, these are also empty of substance. They are convenient fictions too. We say microphone, but this is put together from metal, from plastic, you know, from copper mines in Zambia, or plastic factories in China, probably a few things from Israel, from a few other kibbutzes where they make cables and such like. But you put it together and you call it microphone. Yeah, and so you take the parts that, you know, it's called microphone, but that's a convenient fiction, because if you take the things apart, or where all these elements were 10, 15 years ago, they were all in different countries all around the planet, and they've come together, those same elements, and they're called microphone. And then in 10, 20 years' time, they'll have gone into a landfill, or been broken up, or sitting in a cupboard here at Indore, being a defunct microphone. But sooner or later, it'll crumble and disappear and decay and go back into being earth and metal and smoke. So the term that we use to refer to it is a good enough reference point for the time being, but and that's all. So what the Buddha's pointing to then with Bahia is that when the mind lets go of creating a false solidity in the subject and a false solidity in the object, then the heart is freed. And what is experienced then, as he describes, this is the ending of dukkha, dukkha nirodha. Well, this is a true freedom. The heart is liberated. So I also wanted to, this evening then to touch on, an extension of that, or a deeper, more complete description of that process. And, the term non-dual, is borrowed somewhat from the Vedic tradition. So those of us who have been around the sort of Dharma scene for a few years, you'll be familiar with Advaita Vedanta. So the teachings of people like Srinivasagadatta Maharaj, or Punjaji, or Ajishanti, and such like famous people. So Advaita Vedanta. Vedanta means the teaching or the scripture. Advaita means Advaita. So Adva means Dva is two. Adva means not two. So like I was saying yesterday about gata, meaning gone, and agata meaning come. So the A at the beginning is a negation. So adva means not two. Advaita means of the nature of not two-ness. So Advaita Vedanta is the teaching about not two-ness, non-duality. So you don't find that same terminology exactly in the Buddhist scriptures, but a very closely related term, or the sort of the Buddha's version of, or the word he used to refer to the same quality, is to continue the etymology, is an interesting and somewhat rare word, which is atamayata. Some of you might have heard of this, some of you probably not. Atamayata. So this comes, the word is also derived from the Indian tradition, or the Indian understanding of perception. So there was this view of the way that the mind worked in perceiving things. So say, if I see this good person sitting in front of me, what's your name?
Uded.
So I see Uded. It means that my eye sends out a beam that then goes and occupies Uded, and conforms itself to that object, Uded, and then comes back and then says, Uded. So that becoming consubstantial, to use a complicated word, the quality of going out and becoming united with the object is called tanmayata, consisting of that, tan, that, mayata, made of that. So that process of the energy of the mind going out, absorbing into an object, and then coming back to sort of relay the information, that's described by the term tanmayata or tamayata. So atamayata is not going out and becoming consistent with the object. So it literally means not made of that. So it refers to that quality of the mind not creating a duality of this and that, not made of that. And the ta at the end is the ness, so not made of that ness. So that at least according to my understanding and my exploration of things, this is the Buddha's own terminology for referring to that same subjectless, objectless awareness. And there's describe briefly a particular teaching for us to reflect on. There's a sutta in the middle length discourses, sutta number 137. And in this, the Buddha describes a little sequence, a short sequence. He says, the mind establishes, when the mind establishes equanimity based on diversity, then that leads to, that ripens in equanimity based on unity. And equanimity based on unity then ripens in atamayata. So this might sound a little bit over technical, but basically what it's meaning, and there's different ways of interpreting it, but this is how I feel it's most useful to understand. So equanimity based on diversity is being still, finding stillness in the midst of a lot of different stuff, in the midst of a lot of different that's. That person, you know, these feelings, what's heard, smelt, tasted, and touched. So, in a sense, it's talking about samadhi, that sense of balance, of composure, of centeredness, of, sort of in a way, me being still in the middle of all this stuff. So, equanimity based upon, or in relationship to, multiplicity or diversity. So, then, again, as I was saying yesterday, samadhi naturally ripens in insight. That, as the Buddha put it, when the mind is focused, when there is samadhi, when there is collectedness, there's no need for the person to think, may knowledge and vision of the way things are arise in me, because it's natural for one whose mind is collected and composed to give rise to knowledge and vision of the way things are. So, when the heart is still in the midst of a lot of stuff, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, then that naturally ripens in the recognition that, oh, well, all this stuff is all just anicca, dukkha, anatta. It's just patterns of consciousness arising and passing away. There isn't really a lot of different that's. There is only the phenomena of the mind, the patterns of consciousness. So this is one way of understanding this term, equanimity based on unity. So that there's a unity of experience. And so Vipassana is in a sense helping us to see that unity of experience, that whether it's a sound or a flavor or a memory or an idea, whether it's a sexual fantasy or whether it's a pain in your knee, it's all anicca, dukkha, anatta. There's a unity that the mind is recognizing. But there's still a subject and an object. There's still a knower, a witness, and a witnessed. There's a subject here, a knower, and a known there. And then, so that equanimity, or that stability, that centeredness, based on unity, or vipassana, then ripens in atamayata, which is letting go of subject and object. That there's no this and that, there's no here, there's no there, there's just this. And that dropping of subject and object and freeing the mind from all those structures, this is what atamayata is referring to. So, I just wanted to put that into the mix for everyone to reflect on. It's a lot of long words and maybe some unfamiliar terms, but, I was again chatting with Stephen the other day. So these are really experienced people. This is really the kind of the old guard, you know, that you can just go straight to the teachings at any level you want to, you know, they'll lap it right up. Well, words to that effect, right? So I thought, okay. Let them have it. And so I thought just to put those principles into the mix for you all, and everything's being recorded, so you can go back and catch up on the details later on. But I felt, since this is a good environment to explore these deep and important principles, then it would be unfair not to introduce them to you and to offer them for consideration. So I don't expect everyone to remember these all the different structures, but I feel this is that last part that I was quoting is a helpful way of seeing this relationship of samatha, of concentration, of vipassana, insight, and then atamayata, or that non-dualistic, the subjectless, objectless awareness, or, you know, another way of describing that quality is at that stage of realization, there is simply Dharma aware of its own nature. So I'll leave that with you for the evening and offer these thoughts for reflection. So we'll have our little closing chant now, and then we'll have some walking meditation, and then people can retire for the night. Should we do a Pali chant? Let's do a... Maybe we're still a bit early on for that. Let's do the sharing of blessings once again. So, page 33, if we can have a little bit more light for the... Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā. The Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed one, buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ avivādemi. I render homage to the Buddha, the blessed one. Sakato Bhagavata Dhammo. The teaching so completely explained by him, Tamangmasami. I bow to the Dhamma. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho. The Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, Sangham Namami, I bow to the Sangha.